Years ago, when we lived in Gold River, I would take Sonny the Schnauzer for daily walks along the nature path that connected with the American River Parkway. And often I carried with me a poem written out on an index card, something I was trying to memorize. In this manner, I'd previously memorized the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, but was now onto something by Philip Appleton. Although shorter and lighter than Prufrock, Appleton's poem nevertheless resonated with me as I worried over the actions of the Bush administration. And it is again resonating with me. Every morning, walking along the path, I read the whole poem in a whisper. Oh, karma, dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die. Grant me wisdom, will and wit, purity, probity, pluck and grit. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, kind, give me great abs and a steel trap mind. And forgive ye gods some humble advice. These little blessings would suffice to beget an earthly paradise. Make the bad people good and the good people nice. And before our world goes over the brink, teach the believers how to think. Then I'd put the card in my pocket and repeat as much of the poem as I could from memory. On this particular morning I'm talking about, I'd just put the card away and started softly reading, O karma, dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die. And a squirrel ran across the path and my feisty terrier lunged at it. Jerked off balance, I fell to the ground, my right wrist and hand taking the brunt of the weight. I sat there stunned, waiting for my head to clear, checking things out. Both hands were skinned up. It felt as if my knees might be too, but my jeans were covering whatever damage there may have been there. My right hand and wrist, though, were immovable. Later, as I sat in one of those windowless little cubicles at urgent care, waiting for results of an X-ray, I thought, wait a minute. Every day for the past 2 weeks or more, I had started our walk with, O karma, dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die. Repeated over and over and over. As I sat carefully cradling my throbbing hand and wrist with my good left arm, I couldn't help wondering if there was some truth in that old saying to be careful what you wish for. Maybe I shouldn't be so quick to discount the credibility of common platitudes. I've sometimes wished for the sort of security that must come from living under the umbrella of a micromanaging God, a God who is watching out for each and every one of his children. How comforting it would be when some seemingly random hardship hits, if I could believe it was all part of God's plan for me. But any time I hear that God never gives us more than we can handle, I think, really? Then why is it that in the U.S. every 13 minutes there's a suicide? Oh, wait, I know, it happened for a reason. The woman left behind to raise 3 children on her own will now become a much stronger person. I can't buy it. I'm here because, as anxiety alleviating as the platitudes may be to one who does live under the umbrella of the micromanaging God's protection, I know that there must be room for the certain and inevitable randomness of life under whatever credible meaning I can construct. In his book, Man's Search for Meaning, Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl claims that our primary drive in life is not pleasure, as Freud maintained, but the discovery and pursuit of what we personally find meaningful. The original title in German of Frankl's book is ... to nevertheless say yes to life. Whatever joys or horrors might fill in the beginning ellipsis in that title, our task is to nevertheless say yes to life. I'll take from the other glass. For me, being part of this community, sharing vows to be a force for healing, in the world is a way of saying yes to life, to a life of meaning, even in the midst of random chance.
This is an excerpt from Pancakes and Process Theology by Elizabeth Stevens. In process theology, God, or the spirit of life, or the creative spirit, or goodness, or love, insert whatever word works for you. God works like the scent of pancakes in the morning, to awaken longings deep in the heart, luring not just people, but all creation towards a continually unfolding process of growing and becoming. Perhaps the simplest way to access process theology is to embrace the notion that we are part of a universe of free choosers, a universe that is in the process of becoming what the participants in the universe are choosing to become. In a very fundamental way, we are the choices. Our choices define us, but they also define and determine what the universe becomes. We are co-creators of the universe. So where does God fit in? God, then, is what keeps pulling the universe forward, pulling it towards life and love and peace and connection, keeping it from descending into entropy, stagnation, and collapse. The God of process theology isn't in charge. In a universe of free choosers, God can't make anyone or anything or anyone do anything. But God pulls on the heartstrings and activates deeper, life-giving, and loved-filled longings. The God of process theology doesn't make the rules. Morally, God is ambiguous. As for the end of the process, God doesn't know how it's all going to turn out. God is not all-knowing. God hopes and lures and loves. But God is in the thick of it, just like the rest of us. God is powerful and essential to the continuance of life. And God is helpless to actually concretely do much of anything beyond luring the universe towards wholeness, towards ultimate goodness, towards unconditional love.
My stepson's a senior in high school, and he's about to head off to college. He's one of those kids who's 17 going on 35. Very smart. We've always bantered back and forth with one another, questioning one another's opinions and decisions and life choices. I do this in order that he become a thoughtful, introspective, good human being. He does this to annoy the grits out of me. One day he wondered out loud, why would anyone go to church? What's up with that? Knowing I was in seminary at the time, he probably knew that would annoy me. But after explaining, giving a few reasons, I got to this one. Most people at some point in their lives come to ask the big questions. Now, some people are introspective all their lives and wonder about them. Some people put them on the back burner and wait until perhaps they're older and retired and have time to think about these things. Some people, however, find themselves face to face with these big questions because of a crisis in their life. Some of the big questions include: what is the meaning of life? Is there a higher power? If so, how do we relate and interact with that higher power? And of course, the big one, what happens after we die? I spent a summer as a hospital chaplain and was very surprised that some people not only wait until they're being wheeled into surgery to fill out a medical power of attorney, they wait until that point to also wonder about the big questions. And sometimes I found myself better prepared to notarize a power of attorney than I was to give them a satisfactory answer to some of the questions that they had. Some of the smaller questions I could handle, but then I started to realize maybe my job as a minister, is to help us wonder together and come to answers to these questions that we can all live with. I've also realized many of the big questions, and even more so, some of the smaller questions that spin out from the big questions, are made all the more problematic by one thing: randomness. So let me explain about that. I have here props, that's right. I have here a pair of six-sided dice. Some of you are afraid I'm going to break out into a rousing rendition of Luck Be a Lady Tonight from Guys and Dolls. I considered it. Some of you are just afraid I miss my slinky. No. Neither of those is true. I'm just going to ask you a few questions. Now, please don't shout out your answers. Don't raise your hands. Just think in your head what your answers to these questions might be. Can you predict with uncanny accuracy what number I will roll on these dice? Can you, if I ask you very, very nicely and handed you these dice, could you roll a 7? If you thought to yourself, well, yeah, I can do that. I have to ask you, why are you here and not Vegas? We have a pledge drive coming up. Do you believe that there's a higher power who knows in advance what numbers I will roll on these dice? More so than that, do you believe that higher power might be able to influence what numbers come up on those dice? Or influence what numbers come up on the lottery so that some really deserving person wins that time? Or influences who wins the Grammys or the Super Bowl? God gets thanked an awful lot at those events. These aren't just cute questions to ask on a Sunday morning. They have very deep implications. To what degree are the events in the world random? And to what degree are they intentionally influenced by forces outside of our control? And to what degree are we able to influence them? Your answers to these questions can make huge differences in how you see your place in the world, your beliefs, your attitude. And I believe your answers can influence your sense of agency and can help determine the difference you make in this world. Now, it seems to me a lot of people are afraid of the possibility that some things are, in fact, truly random. It feels safer to believe there is an entity in control and things are going to a plan, even if we don't understand that plan, rather than consider things are random. Marilyn alluded to this very thing. However, this is a big however, if that entity is in control and does nothing to stop horrible random acts, it's easy to wonder to what degree that entity is responsible. And further down the line, it can lead some people to claim random and devastating acts are planned judgment and retribution. UUs have rejected some of that kind of thinking for years. The theology of most of New England's Protestant churches in the 1600s and 1700s was Calvinism. Universalism and Unitarianism were both reactions against Calvinism because that God was harsh and judgmental. Calvinists determined, they sat and thought, you know what? If this God is all-knowing, this God doesn't just know what happened in the past or knows what all is going on right now. He knows what will happen in the future and knows what people will be saved even before those people are born. So once you're born, there's nothing you can do about it. Imagine what that did to people who were very, very concerned about being saved. I have childhood friends who were taught a very harsh and judgmental God, and now, 50 years later, they are still dealing with those images. Over the centuries, the concept of a higher power was so successfully melded with the qualities of all-knowing, all-powerful, and never-changing. It's caused some people to assume they have to throw out a belief in God rather than consider a higher power who doesn't fit that mold. I believe in a higher power, but not one that fits that mold. Let me describe my journey of trying to figure out the answer to this one big question. I was just out of college, and my younger brother passed away just shy of his 18th birthday. He had been suffering for several years from an inoperable brain tumor, and my mother took care of him for those years. The night at the hospital when he passed away was the first time, maybe the only time, that I remember my dad crying, certainly in public. Death was not a frequent visitor in our home. My grandparents would outlive my brother for at least a decade. Both of my parents are still alive. I grew up Methodist and very active in church. And either because of that or despite that, I really don't know. After my brother's death, I came to believe there is a lot of randomness in this world. Buckets full of it. People who just seem despicable to me, whose life seems golden, and people who are just fabulous people but can't catch a break, and incredibly good-hearted teenagers who get a brain tumor and die. I can't explain these things. I will probably never understand all these things. And for me, I don't believe faith is being naive. I believe it is having the humbleness to accept the fact that I will never understand all these things, certainly at least not right now. In one of the essays I wrote for seminary, and you have to write lots of essays to get into seminary, they asked me which big question I might be wrestling with. Well, I didn't choose the whole God versus gay thing. We've kind of got that worked out. No, I chose the why do bad things happen to good things question. Well, later in seminary, I would find out people have been asking this question for centuries. It even has a very fancy word, theodicy. Stacks and stacks of thick books have been written about theodicy. I know because I was assigned to read them all in seminary the same semester. Theodicy involves, among other questions, people asking, if there's a higher power who is all-powerful, how can these dreadful things happen? Or if there's a spirit of love who is all loving. Why this horrible suffering? Even though chaplains are asked these questions a lot, and I've wondered about the answers to these a lot, I don't believe there is one definitive answer. And I learned in the hospital that people who are suffering can smell a platitude or a shallow answer a mile away. Because there isn't one answer that works for some people, they conclude there mustn't be a God, or at least not an all-powerful or all-loving one. And I can certainly relate to that conclusion. I don't believe in a higher power that is all-powerful or never-changing. Let me explain to you. People far smarter than I have written about process theology. And Reverend Lucy read a section to you from the description of process theology by Elizabeth Stevens. I cannot describe to you adequately right now process theology, not because of time constraints, but because I don't totally understand it. But the parts I do understand really resonate with me. I like the idea that there is a spirit of life that is not all-knowing and doesn't know how it's all going to turn out. God hopes and lures and loves and is in the thick of it, just like the rest of us. It's a relationship, and we have the ability to choose. God pulls on the heartstrings and activates deeper, life-giving, and love-filled longings, Reverend Stevens wrote. Our seventh UU principle states our respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We are all a part of that web in a relationship. Because the world is set up for choice, sometimes random things happen, and God hopes and lures and loves, but does not step in to make random good things happen, and does not step in to make the random awful things not happen. In response, we choose what to do in relationship with all the others in our life, and God hopes and lures and loves. Then, once we've seen the results of those decisions, we again choose what to do in relationship with all others in our life, and God hopes and lures and loves. And if what happens is wonderful, the spirit of life is there to rejoice with us. And if what happens is awful, the spirit of love is there to comfort us and walk beside us. So that's where I'm at with figuring out the answer to one of the big questions that is really difficult for me to figure out. For the question, what's the meaning of life? I told my stepson, the meaning is to have compassion and to help one another. He looked skeptical. He told me the answer was 42. For what happens after we die, I've decided the best answer, at least for me, is to not worry about it. To worry about it distracts us from helping one another, which, as I said, is the meaning of life. I hope you're able to take time to think about these big questions, especially before a crisis hits. And I imagine your answers will be different than mine, because we're different people with different experiences. We're here to help each other ask better questions and look for better answers. However, I hope your answers will include something about love and about relationships and helping and supporting one another. If one of us discovered life had rolled the dice, and that person was waiting for the results in a hospital waiting room, or the police station or at your kitchen table, would you be there to support them? If I gave you these dice, you probably couldn't, because I ask you nicely, roll a 7. But if I put them in your hand, I imagine most of you could set them on the table so that 3 was on the top of 1, and you might drop 1. And 4 was on the top of the other. Some things in this world are random. But we are here to do what we can do for each other while we're here. Amen.